Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. The voice of freedom behind enemy lines in the Commonwealth of Virginia, trying to equip you, the patriots, with what you need in the fight for your liberty. Today's episode is going to be a little shorter. I'm going to just be reading the 10th chapter of I Led Three Lives by Herb Philbert. Like to thank ActiCare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge, for sponsoring this show. ActiCare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Campbell, Amherst, out in the country, give them a call. Get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. And John and his staff will take good care of you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
What is communism? I've been on the inside of communism. I still have contacts. From this knowledge, I tell you as simply and seriously as I know how. Communism is a lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined, as J. Edgar Hoover says, a criminal conspiracy. I'm choosing these words deliberately. Lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, determined, and international criminal conspiracy. This is the true nature of the enemy. This is communism.
Chapter 10. Masters of Deceit. In the winter of 1945, Arthur Solomon, the alert and intense young party agent who unwittingly recruited me into the Young Communist League for the FBI, was killed in action in Germany. He died on February 24th, 4 days after he penned me a friendly V-mail letter which he signed Fraternally Yours. Despite the incompatibility of our views, I was saddened by Arthur's death. He gave his life, I knew, in complete devotion to the communist cause, fighting on the side of democracy in obedience to the orders of his opportunist leaders. His sacrifice was ironic, for even at that moment, the top echelons of the party, both here and abroad, were carefully laying plans to turn their big guns against the very cause for which Art died. I am certain that Art would have given his life just as readily in the pursuit of any course laid out for him by the party. Had he lived, he could easily have shifted his ground from the battle against Nazism to the renewal of the party's all-out war against capitalist imperialism. Shortly after word came of Solomon's death, a letter written in the name of the French communist leader Jacques Duclos exploded in the faces of the party leadership in the United States and shook the ranks of the party almost as violently as the infamous 1941 somersault to support the war. The Duclos affair was a full-scale internal revolt, although it was carefully screened from the public's gaze. It squelched Earl Browder's deviation and ended his hope of American exceptionalism. It rudely purged any illusions of future collaboration with capitalism and swerved the Communist Party sharply to the left. It affected almost every member of the party. In my case, it moved me from the perimeter toward the epicenter of conspiracy, where I was in a better position to keep track of events for the FBI. The communist atmosphere in the fall and winter of 1944-45 was charged with advance warnings of the Duclos storm. The tide of war, both in Europe and the Pacific, had turned. There were still plenty of home front issues for the Communist Party to support on its Win the War platform, but it was clear that they would not last forever. On the long-term planning level, the Browder Party was faced with the ultimate loss of its central rallying point, the winning of the war, which was now almost won. Cooperation with capitalism would never keep communism alive. The party and its front organizations were losing membership. Something had to be done. Once again, it was within the communist youth organizations, with which I, as the party floater, was most intimately connected, that the signal flags first went up. Orders from above directed a tightening of policies and discipline within the ranks of the American Youth for Democracy, of which I was the Massachusetts state treasurer. After reaching a peak of more than 1,500 dues-paying members in the Boston area, AYD rapidly lost ground on its Win the War program. With the breakthrough into Germany and the Nazi failure at the Battle of the Bulge, the membership and interest in AYD dropped off. A special meeting was called at the apartment of Dave and Barbara Bennett to start a new membership drive for the youth group. The session was limited to AYD leaders who were members of the Communist Party. Barbara Bennett told us that the AYD would continue to function as a victory coalition, embracing communist as well as non-communist youth. But at the same time, she said, we must be more selective in our recruiting and take care not to enlist any Trotskyites or anti-labor and anti-progressive elements. Trying to build my party position, I suggested that the Young Communist League should be reestablished, but I was slapped down for meddling with national policies. The failure to rebuild the Young Communist League was a grievous party error. The communist youth movement in the United States has never been the same since. While an ideological purge was thus started on a small scale, it was also time to screen the AYD membership for possible recruits to the regular Communist Party. The word came down to open a leadership training course for hand-picked youngsters who might be good prospects. We selected about 65 young people and induced them with promises of leadership in AYD activities to sign up for the course. The old familiar spider web was spun again. The new indoctrination program was given a high priority. A national party functionary, Marcella Sloan, was sent to Boston to direct the training personally. The classes were held at the big AYD auditorium on Huntington Avenue. They followed the pattern of my own pre-induction schooling in 1942. Marxism was cleverly and covertly woven into a sturdy fabric made up of the most acute post-war issues, many of which were to be found even in the Republican and Democratic platforms. Among them were fair employment practice legislation, federal aid to education, support of the Dumbarton-Oaks Agreement, measures to ensure post-war jobs, and any issue which might appeal to a progressive-minded young person. Only those quite familiar with party teachings could detect Marxist warps in the cloth. Communism was never mentioned, except that all anti-communism was firmly but discreetly branded as red-baiting. I attended a number of classes as an observer, and I found that several other seasoned members, some of them out of my own former cells, were also to be present. We were admonished not to fraternize too closely in the presence of others and to pose as beginners along with the rest. I thought at first that most of the party veterans were on hand merely to keep an eye on the new students and help the instructor weed out any who did not show promise as communist material. But there was more to it. The secret party plants gradually emerged as floor leaders for class discussions, discussions which were designed to instill the first principles of communist action into young minds which would not accept it in large, heavy doses. It had to be done with subtlety. Marcella Sloan, for example, would toss out a question regarding the attitude of AYD members on a federal Fair Employment Practices Act. A newcomer would suggest that, of course, such law should be passed. Why? Marcella would ask, and a bright young student would come up with the answer. Well, to put an end to discrimination. Do you think a law will stop discrimination? Would be the next question, and the students would kick that one around. Why does discrimination exist, and where do you find it? Was the next logical step. Most of the students, who had never gone that far into it before, were puzzled by this one. They contrived all manner of answers based on history and sociology, as much as they knew about it, and Marcella would tolerate the discussion until she felt it was necessary to put across the party viewpoint. Then, with the students sufficiently prepared to accept it without too much argument, one of the party veterans would come up with the right answer. Racial and religious discrimination is found primarily in industry. Industrialism and its leaders must foster discrimination in order to force wages down to create a second or third class labor supply which can be exploited at starvation wage levels. It is simply a matter of the capitalist economy under which we live. There it would stop, just short of the next logical step regarding the necessity to overturn the existing system. There was no indoctrination in revolution, only the installation of ideas which would lead up to it. The first planting of the seeds of class strife, the theme that every social ill has its roots in capitalism. The communist veterans in the class frequently asked just the right questions, which would afford Marcella an opportunity to supply the correct Marxist answer herself. Their loaded queries and Marcella's prepared responses made it all appear as a spontaneous development of ideas in an atmosphere of free intellectual exchange. The non-communist beginners in the class didn't know it, but the plants were pitching the ball straight over the plate, and Marcella was knocking them out of the ballpark. But there was no hint of the contrivance, except to those such as myself who had been through the mill. Now I recognized that not all of my fellow students in my Banks Street classes in Cambridge several years before had been rank beginners. There, too, party plants had been used to blaze the discussion trail. That was why it all went off so smoothly. Standing at the rear of the room, watching the performance, and it was a dazzling performance, I shook my head in wonderment. There seemed to be no end to communist methods of deception, and to this day I still view with awe each new revelation of their trickery. One of J. Edgar Hoover's best books on communism is entitled Masters of Deceit. It is an accurate description. A communist is indeed a master of deceit, a fact proven by the record. Some of the 65 carefully selected AYD fledglings dropped out midway in Marcella Sloan's course, went on later to a postgraduate course in the Samuel Adams School for Social Studies, the educational center in Boston, which was sponsored and supported by the communists. Even while the party vigorously denied it, the four-week course was designed to teach them about the shining future and to give them the party's slant on the United Nations, problems of national unity, and employment. Once again, the schooling consistently stopped short of revolution. But whereas in their first indoctrination classes, the social evils of capitalist democracy were infused, now the discussion led to the absolute necessity of making sharp changes in the social, economic, and governmental system. Among the instructors for the Sam Adams course was the school's treasurer, Harry Winner, a Malden, Massachusetts businessman, an executive with the Converse Rubber Company, of many years standing, a man whose talent as a teacher were widely appreciated by the party, even if they were overlooked by his business associates. While the ranks of the youth organization were being tightened, the party hierarchy showed other signs that they sensed the unpopularity of Browderism and the impending swing to the left. The party leader shrewdly perceived that the move away from Browder would leave a large segment of the fringe membership hanging in the air, unless some provision could be made to give them a footing and maintain control of their political influence for the party's advantage. Accordingly, the district officers turned their attention to the problem of finding an above-ground political action group, free of the communist label, to serve that purpose. I was assigned by district headquarters to the task of infiltrating a liberal group known as the Massachusetts Political Action Committee, to survey the organization and determine whether the PAC could be taken over and used as a political front by the party. I reported that I thought the committee, composed of true liberals, was ill-suited to Communist Party purposes, and that it might be better to establish a similar group of our own. Many others agreed with me. Thus, Earl Browder's flabby Communist Political Association, which had shunned divisive politics during the war years, laid the groundwork for the Progressive Party and the direct engagement once more in the political arena. It was a sign of coming events. Still another was the falling off of membership, which resulted in a scramble for funds to support party and front activities. Early 1945 found us in a desperate need of money. A concentrated effort was decreed to pull us out of the hole. Every conceivable fundraising dodge was used, and nowhere is communist cynicism more fully displayed. One of my major assignments during this period was a treasury drive for American Youth for Democracy. It was no longer sufficient to tax dwindling membership or to rely on door-to-door solicitation. We had to seize a cause and convert it to cash. We decided to appeal for money to continue the work of AYD, but we had our tongues in our cheeks because we knew all the time that what we needed was money to pay off back debts preparatory to liquidation of the organization. Working with Don Ballin, the AYD state chairman, Bob McCarthy, national board member of AYD, Barbara Bennett, who replaced Alice Gordon as district leader of Communist Youth Work, and others, I drew up a plan for a Youth on Parade dinner ostensibly to pay homage to the youth of Boston for their sacrifices both at home and on the field of battle. In consultation with district party leaders, we drew up a list of carefully selected young people to be the guests of honor and to receive certificates of achievement. A returning serviceman, a war worker, a nurse's aide, a canteen worker, an artist, a musician, a youth leader. We corralled Dr. Hugh Cabot, a frequent sponsor of and contributor to our causes, and a man whose name was synonymous with Boston, to officiate at the ceremonies. Professor F.O. Mathiason of Harvard was to be the chairman of the evening. I made the final arrangements for the Youth on Parade dinner to be held in the evening of March 19th at the Hotel Vendome in Boston. I was assigned to write a letter soliciting the usual sponsors for the affair. After receiving the approval of the Communist Party headquarters, the letter was signed by Professor Mathiason. In our press release and public notices, we manufactured an aura of community pride in the accomplishments of youth, which was to pervade the whole affair. But all the time, we had our eyes on the cash box. Those invited to attend the dinner and to contribute to AYD were carefully screened. The name of each prospective donor was written down on a card, together with an analysis of the best and most opportune manner of approach. We studied the particular appeal to which each was most likely to respond, whether it was politics, philanthropy toward young people, interest in interfaith or interracial work, tolerance, or simply good citizenship. We had at least one such weak spot for everybody. We also asked each donor to give us the names of friends who might be expected to make contributions. Tables at the dinner were sold to civic organizations and trade unions for $50 to $100. It was an evening of goodwill, good food, music, sparkling conversation, and a spontaneity that belied the careful preparations. One of the guests of honor was Mrs. Harold A. Fletcher, Jr., Martha, as she was known to hundreds of Boston young people for her youth work in the Unitarian Church. Martha was tall, with beautiful classic features and a long brunette mane. She had a bright mind, warm personality, and a self-assurance that was reflected in her modulated, vibrant voice. Poised and charming, she made a sincere appeal for continued support of the magnificent work of the AYD. She was the hit of the evening, and likewise the star of the motion picture made of the entire affair for the picture files of the FBI. The dinner raised approximately $1,000 for the Treasury, 100 of which went into the National Office of AYD. The rest was used to pay off telephone bills, rent, printing costs, the salaries of Don Ballin and Bernice Rogers, who was state chairman of the Sweethearts of Servicemen program, and to shrink the AYD down from its spacious Huntington Avenue headquarters to a small office at 7 Water Street, the same building in which I started my communist career. It was in April that the Duclos letter fell on soil that was prepared for it. It took root quickly and blossomed into a full-fledged anti-Browder revolt. The letter by Jacques Duclos was published in Cahiers du Communisme, a theatrical organ of the Communist Party of France. Long-winded and dull, replete with dialectical gymnastics, the letter was actually a directive from the International Communist Movement, ordering the party in the United States to put its house in order. It was understood to have the backing of the Cominform and the Kremlin, and it was accepted as law. Few people outside the party plowed through Duclos's article, but inside the party, it was required reading. The letter pounced on the hapless Browder for dissolving the party and creating the Communist Political Association. It chastised him for taking views which led him to say in a speech at Bridgeport, Connecticut, that he would clasp the hand of J.P. Morgan if Morgan would go along on the Anglo-Soviet-American alliance and the Tehran Agreement. Duclos called for the rejection of the collaboration, for the burial of the Communist Political Association, and for the restoration of a powerful and militant Marxist Communist Party in the United States. He listed the following major flaws in Browderism. 1. The course applied under Browder's leadership ended in practice in liquidation of the independent political party of the working class in the United States. 2. Despite declarations regarding recognition of the principles of Marxism, one is witnessing a notorious revision of Marxism on the part of Browder and his supporters, a revision which is expressed in the concept of a long-term class peace in the United States, of the possibility of the suppression of the class struggle in the post-war period, and of establishment of harmony between labor and capital. By transforming the Tehran Declaration of the Allied Governments, which is a document of a diplomatic character, into a political platform of class peace in the United States in the post-war period. The American communists are deforming in a radical way the meaning of the Tehran Declaration and are sowing dangerous opportunist illusions, which will exercise a negative influence on the American labor movement if they are not met with the necessary reply. He decried Browder's hopes for peaceful measures toward a constitutional socialism and placed the party back on a forceful footing. Furthermore, he said, arguing this point, one can observe a certain confusion in Browder's declarations regarding the problem of nationalization of monopolies and what he calls the transition from capitalism to socialism. Nationalization of monopolies actually in no sense constitutes a socialist achievement, contrary to what certain people would be inclined to believe. No, in nationalization, it is simply a matter of reforms of a democratic character. Achievement of socialism being impossible to imagine without preliminary conquest of power. This directive was a ringing challenge, timed to coincide with victory in the war and to bring back the sharp class struggle in an atmosphere of anticipated demobilization and domestic turmoil. The gauntlet flung down by Duclos was quickly picked up by most communists in the United States, who saw the handwriting on the wall. Browder, of course, could not reverse his field and stay in with any grace. Whether or not it was by prior understanding with common form, he would have to be sacrificed as the scapegoat of the conciliatory wartime Communist Party in the country. Browder had served his purpose. As a faithful party member, he would have to go. In all probability, he would make a good show of lone opposition so that it would look like a domestic party affair, free from international pressure. The reaction to the shot in the party's arm by Duclos was swift. The National Committee of the Communist Political Association obediently began groveling in self-criticism over the errors of its ways and took steps to act in accordance with the Duclos letter. A draft resolution was prepared for submission to state and district conventions of the association calling for the prompt dissolution of the CPA and restoration of the party in its old form. It was to be strengthened, however, by a new constitution which demanded a more vigorous form of democratic centralism and a tighter hierarchy of control of the party's destinies. I was in the district headquarters when some of the directives concerning the Duclos affair came in from the national headquarters. I was not permitted to see them, but the discussion in the office told me which way the wind was blowing. Sitting on the corner of a desk, I heard the party functionaries, Otis Hood, Fanny Hartman, Jack Green, Ann Burlack, Alice Gordon, go through their verbal gyrations. Green blasted Earl Browder straight down the line. "I never did like that bastard," he cried. "He's been bought out by the capitalists and turned the party over to them, lock, stock, and barrel. It's about time we got rid of him." "I don't know," I hazard. "Let's look at this thing from a sales point of view. We've had a good many members come in on the basis of Browderism. Look at AYD, for example. We've just enrolled several new party members through them, haven't we?" I looked at Alice Gordon. She nodded, giving me the answer to a question of interest to me and the Bureau. "Okay. Now, we've gone to a lot of work to get these people. We've been telling them that Browder is a hero. We might lose them if we turn right around and make Browder out to be a heel." Green turned on me fiercely. "Don't tell me you've fallen for that tripe, comrade," he sneered, looking at me, so that I was sharply reminded of Green's position as the chief security agent of the district, whose job it was to weed out deviationists in high places and low. "Quite the contrary," I shot back, returning his gaze as firmly as I could. "I think my record will bear me out." Alice Gordon backed me up. "That's right," she said. "In our cell, it was Comrade Herb who held out the longest of all against Browder. And from the very beginning, I didn't pause long enough to let it sink in because I was afraid someone might ask me what had caused me to change my mind. I'm looking at this thing purely from a practical angle. When you say that we've got to get rid of Browder and his whole gang, I agree, but I don't want to lose any of the membership then I can help. I can see a drop of 20% anyway, but I don't see why we should ask for a 50% drop. I think we ought to take steps to hold on to what we have." Otis Hood, who was much more congenial than Jack Green and the district's best student of Marxism, agreed with me and offered an explanation. "Your position is sincere, I know," Hood said, "although it constitutes a Menshevik error. You're right. Many intellectuals, professors, university and high school students will remain outside the Communist Party even though they may have joined such a group as the Communist Political Association. But the party itself does not need members who shrink from party discipline and are afraid to join it. At the same time, we will not lose their political influence because we will have a place for them. And what is that? I asked. The Political Action Committee. The PAC? Sure. Many who will refuse to become dues-paying, card-holding party members will still enter into an alliance with us in such an organization. These people are the coattailers, and Comrade Green is right in saying that they are not to be trusted as party members. But that does not bar us from inviting them to join a political action group with us, eh? My exchange with Green and others served two purposes. First, it brought to the attention of the district leadership in this time of crisis that I had been a strong Marxist-Leninist revolutionary, even when Browderism was most rampant. Second, it gave rise to a maneuver which was apparently unique in the District 1 organization. A special 4-page flyer was printed with planted material defending Browder. The object of the scheme was to let the national chairman down easy, so as not to disillusion too many of the new party members with a rude rejection. Someone had to take the pro-Browder role in the district, and by pre-arrangement, the task fell on Otis Hood, who was, during the Browder interval, a minor official in the district. Anne Burlack, as titular head of District 1, was to accept the brunt of the party criticism for steering the party along the Browder line. Hood, also by pre-arrangement, was to be given an opportunity to switch his position later and clear himself by confession. Thus, the party contrived a deliberate show of democracy in the great Foster-Browder debate as a concession to the new members who joined during the era of Browderism. The Browder position was put up like a tin can on the fence so that we could shoot it full of holes with the big guns. Such are the ways of communist manipulation. But the switch back to a militant party was the watchword. Discipline was the slogan of the day, and members were expected to go along or get kicked out. Big Three unity was no longer importuned. Division was stressed, and Marxism was restored. The government, through the FBI, watched the trend of the party with renewed interest. There was a flurry of exchanges between me and the Bureau, and the questions put to me by them were much more probing than those asked by the man in the street. It was obvious that the party was preparing a big shift to the left. The question that Harold Leary wanted to answer was how far to the left it would go. I tried in vain to find out. The leaders in the party hacks in District 1 were full of words, but to a man they declined to make any flat predictions. Would this revival of Marxism include the imminent destruction of capitalism and a swift move toward violent revolution in the war's immediate aftermath? One of my first tasks in connection with the Castle Revolt was to serve as courier and emissary between the district headquarters and the Malden branch of the party. Go down to the Progressive Bookshop at 8 Beet Street, I was ordered by Dave Bennett, the state secretary, and pick up some material there. Tell them you are authorized to do so without payment. We'll see that it gets straightened out later. They will tell you where to take everything. So I made my debut at the public propaganda headquarters of the Communist Party in Boston. The Progressive Bookshop was a few doors down from Washington Street. I was surprised to find my old Wakefield cell comrade, Frank Collier, in charge. He was as morose as I had remembered him, and permitted himself no demonstration at seeing me again. The bookshop had shelves of Marxist-Leninist classics, current and back copies of communist magazines, racks of the Daily Worker and the Worker, some books, such as the old reliable History of the CPSUB, were sold to trusted customers. Collier packed up a bundle of pamphlets and circulars. I asked him for directions. These go to 34 Holkey Street. Malden, Rank told me. On the appointed evening, a day or so later, I made a hot, dusty way by streetcar and bus to a selection of Malden that was unfamiliar to me. The address turned out to be a 4-family double-deck house in a working-class district. Under the second-floor apartment number given to me, there was listed simply the name Mills, my old friend Alice Mills, now the leader of the Malden branch. Alice looked better than she had when I first met her more than 5 years before in the Massachusetts Youth Council. She told me that Nat was in military service, but she appeared to be weathering his stint well. She was in charge of the activities of some 100 party members in neighborhood cells in Malden, Somerville, Everett, Melrose, Wakefield, and Stoneham. The cells were composed of residents of these communities, mostly workers and housewives. In the subsequent orientation meetings with the cells in Alice's Ballywick, We disseminated the new party line to the membership in preparation for the district convention of the party, scheduled for July. Following the outlines prepared for us by district headquarters, we castigated Browder and harped endlessly on the necessity for restoration of the party. We envisaged for the membership a sharpening of all the inner and outer contradictions of American capitalism, an intensification of the class conflict in the United States, a renewed struggle on behalf of the colonial peoples, and a sharper division between the two world systems of capitalism and socialism. All comrades in the branch were corralled into cell meetings and belabored with hours of indoctrination. The Malden branch was instructed to elect 3 delegates and 3 alternates to the Big July Convention. The windup saw me elected as one of the alternates on the 6-man delegation. This was fortunate for the FBI, because if they had asked me to crash the convention, I could not have done so. It was the most carefully guarded and secretive convention ever held in the district. The party bosses were zealous in their efforts to keep out spies, newspaper reporters, party wreckers, and deviationists, anyone who might upset the carefully planned program. Furthermore, the party was anxious to show its own members that the careless era of Browder was ended, and that the new tough vanguard of the working class would brook no nonsense. Extreme security precautions were exercised. Every delegate was carefully screened. Nothing was left to chance. Identification cards were issued for those who were to attend the 3 sessions spread out from Saturday evening to Sunday. It was not enough to merely be designated as a delegate by the party branch. Each representative's name was forwarded to headquarters for careful screening by the Credentials Committee, headed by party boss Mark Alper. Only after approval by him were the cards issued. 1 color for delegates, 1 for alternates, and 1 for the very few visitors who were invited to be present. Each card listed the real or party name of the delegate, and it was stamped with a serial number for cross-checking against a master list. So this is an interesting chapter, because what's happened here is the party was going with this kind of go-along-to-get-along thing during the war. And as soon as the war was winding down, they went, okay, now we're done with that stuff, back to the business's usual business at hand. And a few of them got slapped down, and this Browder guy too. And here's some interesting things I pulled out of this one. The communist youth movement in the United States has never been the same since. And that was same since they got rid of the Youth Communist League. And I disagree. The communist youth movement in America is alive and well, and we can see it everywhere we go, whether it's our school systems or whatever, universities, civic groups, Antifa, Black Lives Matter. Oh, it's moving along just fine. Here's another one. I thought at first that most of the party veterans were on hand merely to keep an eye on the new students and to help the instructor weed out any who did not show promise as communist material. But there was more to it. The secret party plants gradually emerged as floor leaders for the class discussion, discussions which were designed to instill the first principles of communist action into young minds which would not accept it in large, heavy doses. It had been done with subtlety. It had to be done with subtlety. I like this line, talking about capitalism, the words starvation wage levels. We've heard that before, not too recently, I'm sure. Here's one. Now I recognize that not all of my fellow students in my Bank Street classes in Cambridge several years before had been ranked beginners. There, too, party plants had been used to blaze the discussion trail. That was why it all went off so smoothly. Standing at the rear of the room watching the performance, and it was a dazzling performance, I shook my head in wonderment. There seemed to be no end to a communist method of deception. And to this day, I still view with awe each new revelation of their trickery. So I always think it's interesting. He just can't seem to come to grips, even though he knows, and he's seen it time and again, he can't seem to come to grips with their methods, even though he's in the midst of it, and it still surprises him. Once again, the schooling consistently stopped short of revolution, but whereas in their first indoctrination classes, the social evils of capitalist democracy were infused, now the discussion led to the absolute necessity of making sharp changes in the social, economic, and governmental systems. Sound familiar? This is exactly what's going on right now in America. I mean, to a T. And you're going to especially see it in the squad and, you know, the AOC types that are really running the Democratic Party in America right now. But you really see it clear there. And that's a perfect, she's a perfect example, actually, of a lot of the stuff we're talking about in this book, because it was a joke, a gag to get her elected. A bartender. She was a nobody, nothing. Basically somebody that auditioned to be a congressperson. A blithering idiot. And yet, she won the audition, and these people pushed her forward. And as you'll see later in the book, they get involved in political campaigns. Oh, I like this last line that I pulled out here. Furthermore, the party was anxious to show its own members that the careless era of Browder was ended and that the new, tough vanguard of the working class would brook no nonsense. I love that. Brook no nonsense. It's a very 50s, 40s and 50s era phrase. We don't really hear that anymore. I'll brook no nonsense from you, mister. Not really relating to communism at all. I just thought it was kind of cool. So another chapter in the bag there for Herb. Again, seeing the inside workings of this, we would have no idea were it not for him infiltrating the Communist Party. We would know the inner workings like we know them here. I want to thank you for listening. I invite you to come back next week. I will be talking about a couple different things. Definitely talking about the direction that Bumbles wants to take America in regards to your Second Amendment liberties. I'll also be going over any laws that have passed in Richmond. To my knowledge, none have yet been signed by our bumbling oaf of a governor. And I will also be going over some of the stuff that is being foisted upon our military and the consequences I think that will have here at home and across the nation. I want to remind you, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.